This is Pro Bono Radio. Hey there, I'm Waylon.
I'm Parnian.
I'm Luke.
And today we're going to be talking about self-defense.
So we're going to be examining self-defense in the criminal law context, the history of this defense, how it's been used, and why one professor is so worried about recent reforms to the law of self-defense in Canada.
So this one professor is Professor Wiseford at Queen's Law University here. And well, we're all very aware of how esteemed all our professors are, but this one specific professor and his casual 8 degrees is quite esteemed. And so we're very excited to talk to him today. And just for the listeners out there, if you were curious about his degrees, he's got a Bachelor of Science, Bachelor of Social Work, Bachelor of Common Law, Bachelor of Civil Law, Masters of Social Work, Masters of Laws program from Harvard Law School, as well as a Doctor of Juridical Science, also from Harvard Law School. So we're very excited.
Yeah, pretty much he's a very smart man, and we're very lucky to have him on the program. Now, Professor Wiseboard's interests, as you would suspect, are in the criminal law context. Most of his recent work has actually been on international criminal law, particularly the crime of aggression. He's got an upcoming book called The Crime of Aggression, The Quest for Justice in an Age of Drones, Cyber Attacks, Insurgents, and Autocrats. But actually recently, since coming back to Canada, he's been focusing in on the self-defense and criminal law just in the Canadian context. So that's what he's been focusing on lately, and that's what we'll be talking to him today. He's also got an article coming out about that called Who's Afraid of the Lucky Moose? Canada's Dangerous Self-Defense Innovation.
All right, and without further ado, here's our interview with Professor Noah Wiseboard.
Okay, so Professor, why don't you start us off with just a brief overview of your research in this area, self-defense in Canada?
Well, I guess I started off getting interested in this when I saw what was happening in Florida with the Stand Your Ground law. So under the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, in 2005, the state expanded the right to use deadly force in self-defense. So under the old common law principles that existed at the time in the US, but also in Canada for the longest time, if you were going to use deadly force when you were attacked, you had to do so having first tried to retreat. And the rule came from Blackstone. It was stated by Blackstone and said that you had to try to retreat to the ditch or the wall before using deadly force. The idea was to preserve the life of the person attacked, but also of the attacker. So they didn't have these preemptive strikes. Anyway, in 2005, in Florida, a big push by the National Rifle Association, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, some other politicians were saying that, well, we should remove that requirement of retreat. So that anyone who's allowed to be somewhere lawfully doesn't have to sacrifice their honor and their liberty and move from there. They should be able to use deadly force as they please. So that was called the Stand Your Ground law in 2005. So there's a whole history that leads up to that. Then in Canada, just as an introduction, our current situation, so my paper is about the Canadian law. It compares the history of the American Stand Your Ground law with the history of Canada's expanded law, which I call the Lucky Moose law. Why Lucky Moose? So in 2009, I think, there was a shoplifter named Anthony Bennett, African-Canadian guy, who goes into the Lucky Moose food mart in Toronto's Chinatown area. And Anthony Bennett is recorded on the video bicycling away with a tray of flowers from David Chen's store. Now, David Chen's been robbed, like, dozens and dozens of times, and he's losing a fortune on shoplifting. So he's pretty furious. So when he sees Anthony Bennett come back, maybe to steal more flowers, Chen and two of the other employees chase Bennett down the alley. They subdue him. They bind him. They put him in the back of a delivery van, and then they call the police. Police come. Chen claims citizen's arrest. Bennett presses charges against Chen for assault, unlawful confinement, use of a concealed weapon, which was the box cutter that Chen had on him. This becomes huge front page news all over the place in Canada, national press. All these shopkeepers in Toronto, East Asian, South Asian, that are upset about all the shoplifting taking place, are kind of activated by this issue. And this is at the time the conservative government was a minority government, and they want to appeal to these small business owners in the greater Toronto area to expand into a majority government. So they use polling data from that they get from the sophisticated polling system. They have an advisor who creates a strategy called the Real Ethnic Strategy. The guy later gets fired because of the terminology that he uses, where they're going to target conservatives are going to use money from stable conservative ridings in the prairies and in the West to fund targeting of these shopkeepers in the greater Toronto area and win their majority. So what's in common with these kind of true grit Canadians, and I forget the word the conservatives use to describe it, and the shopkeepers, socially conservative, small business owners, often religious, often Christian, and suddenly David Chen becomes a very valuable political asset. So he's front page news, and they say, we're going to expand citizens' arrest so that you don't have to wait for the police to come before you can defend your shops. They win their majority government. One of the early things that the conservatives do is to start to draft laws that would expand citizens' arrest. By the way, David Chen is acquitted even before the new law. The judge interprets the law so that citizens' arrest doesn't have to just take place when the crime is occurring or immediately after, but a reasonable time after the crime has occurred. So he's acquitted, but still the conservatives go push to expand the law. It's supported by Liberals and NDP. It's too big of a political issue, and it's too important of a constituency to ignore. Olivia Chow proposes draft legislation. The Liberals do as well. And along with the citizens' arrests law, Parliament, without much debate or consideration, decides to simplify, air quotes, Canada's self-defense law and defense of property. So what they do is they say, okay, this is a mess. It's been a history of kind of these special provisions for different circumstances of self-defense. For example, if you're an innocent person defending yourself, there was one rule. If you're the initial attacker defending yourself and then it goes south, there's another rule. If you're defending yourself against an unlawful assault and then you intend to use deadly force, there's another provision. If you intend to not use deadly force, there's another provision. I think it was David Pachauco called this self-defense legislation and jurisprudence the most confusing section of law known to man or something. It's like it was a total mess before 2013.
Yeah.
So Parliament tries to simplify. But in the process, what they do is they actually subtly expand self-defense in ways that I believe make it more permissive of do-it-yourself violence than the Florida Stand Your Ground law. Oh.
So just to give the listeners a bit of an overview, in expanding the citizen arrest laws, are we seeing a shift from self-defense being, you know, used as a preservation of life towards more of a preservation of, you know, property?
Exactly. Okay. So this is exactly what I'm concerned about, is that what you're seeing in the U.S. in 2005 with the expansion of the self-defense law to stand your ground and the Canadian law is that defense that was based on the preservation of life is slowly shifting to become based on the preservation of property, liberty, and honor. So, for example, in Canada, there's never been a permissible defense of property using deadly force. You could never use deadly force to defend mere property. But under the new defense of property provision, that's never mentioned at all. As long as the defense of property was reasonable in the circumstances, lawful possession of property, reasonable in the circumstances, then the defense will succeed. And what's reasonable in the circumstances? For defense of property, Section 35 of the new law, there are no criteria that are listed. So whatever the jury or the finder of fact, if it's the trial judge, determines was reasonable at the time, without any reference to proportionality, which was part of the old common law, necessity, part of the old common law, these things are all debrided from the law. There's no more requirements. So it's a finding of fact by the jury. Was the use of force reasonable in the circumstances, giving rise to the possibility that someone can use a defense of property if the jury is sympathetic after they've killed somebody for stealing their cell phone. So I'm very concerned about that.
Yeah, certainly. You mentioned defining a fact there. It seems like in the old days, it was very much a legal question, right? And used in very strict circumstances. Whereas now, it's opened up just to reasonable in the circumstances. And that, I think, the problem becomes we get accused who often are very sympathetic kind of characters or can spin a story and people sympathize with that. Well, he was just defending his property. He was defending himself, right? And I think we've seen that played out. The David Chen case is a classic example, but I'm assuming you would also argue that it played out in cases like Kill, Stanley, and Cormier.
Okay, yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Well, that's okay. So those are the three cases that concern me the most. You put your finger on exactly the signs of worry that I'm seeing in Canada. And this is also why the Canadian law of self-defense, I think, is broader than the American law. Let me just explain. Let's talk about the Stanley, Cormier, and Kill cases. These cases show the potential expansiveness of the new Canadian law of self-defense. In Cormier, this is a case that went up to the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. Cormier was inside his house. He was receiving threats from Eldridge, who claims that Cormier owed him a debt. Actually, the house belonged to Cormier's dad, Cormier Sr. Cormier is inside the house, another guy, and Eldridge is saying, we're going to smash all the windows, and he challenged Cormier to a fight. Eldridge goes away for a few hours, texts Cormier that he's coming back to smash all the windows. Eldridge shows up on the stoop of Cormier Sr.'s house. Cormier Jr., Cormier Sr., and another guy open the door. They're in a safe place. They could have called the police. But no, they open the door in defense, so they claim, of defense of property. So if that's true under the new expansive law, then they're allowed to be doing what they're doing. And this is what the New Brunswick Court of Appeals suggested could be happening here. At that point, the facts are contested, but Cormier claims that Eldridge swung a pipe at him, whereupon Cormier stabs Eldridge to death and then claims self-defense. Mm. The New Brunswick Court of Appeal then says that there was an error that the Crown was employing, that Cormier forfeited his self-defense claim when he exited the house. But under the new self-defense law and defense of property laws, the New Brunswick Court of Appeal says that's wrong. The judge should have instructed that that is not a reason to forfeit a claim of self-defense any longer, especially. And the Cormier, the New Brunswick Court of Appeal says also, and this is really interesting, that though the Department of Justice describes the new law in their kind of a manual explaining the new law as being just a simplification of the old law, no expansion. In fact, when you look at it in the light of these articles by Kent Roach, David Pachocco, and these other legal scholars, this is a total change in the way that self-defense is conceptualized in Canada. That's now the leading case on the new self-defense law, Cormier. Mm-hmm. Defense of property morphs into defense of person. And Cormier, who's defending a house, not only his own castle, he's defending his dad's house, is allowed to exit a place of safety, confront a guy, kill him, and then claim self-defense. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening in Florida. I'm worried about.
It seems like with that case in particular, we've shifted from the idea that the police are the ones with monopoly on force, monopoly on violence. And now it almost seems like this law, particularly in that case, it encourages vigilantism and it perpetuates this image in my mind that a person has a right to go out and, you know, do battle and then duel almost. It reminds me very much of, I don't know, have you ever seen the movie Death Wish, Charles Bronson, that old movie?
Yeah, I heard of it.
Yeah, it's a little like that, or like a John Wayne Western or something, right? Like the person can go out and take the law into his own hands. Right. And in that case in particular, right, it was a very violent self-defense, right? Like he stabbed him to death. That's not something, he swung a pipe and he responded with far disproportionate force. It seems amazing.
Yeah, it's starting to look Wild West. Sorry.
It wasn't kind of like he was trying to get him off the land. He was at that point, he's like, well, this person's coming at me, so I'm going to do whatever I can to, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't, like it seems like before, defense of property was more like a legitimate defense of protecting yourself, or if you had to protect your your castle. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it kind of, it's a, you know, I see someone on my lawn or I have the right to get him off by any means possible. Mm-hmm.
It could be. It depends on whether the jury considers it reasonable in the circumstances. Yeah, sure. So you're right. I mean, the defense of property had morphed into defense of person in Canada before. There had been cases, but this Cormier case really brings it to the next level. Okay. We're talking about the Wild West here. So let's talk about the Stanley case. Okay. So a lot of you followed this probably in the news. So Gerald Stanley and Sheldon Stanley, his son, are building a fence. It's in the late afternoon, Battleford, Saskatchewan. SUV, it looks pretty beat up. Flat tire comes onto their property. Now Sheldon and Gerald Stanley had a garage where they fixed people's cars. So it's unclear why the SUV is coming onto the property, but Sheldon and Gerald think that maybe they're there to steal because there'd been a spate of thefts in the area. So they, I think it was Sheldon that uses the hammer he's using to build the fence to smash the front window of the SUV. Gerald's kicks the back light. Two of the kids go exiting from the back of the car that are in the car. They get on some quads that the Stanleys have there. I don't remember the order exactly, but they're fleeing the car at this point. Gerald goes into the shed. Sheldon goes into the house. Sheldon's either going to get some keys to pursue these kids, this car, or a shotgun. It's disputed. Gerald takes his old handgun, Czech Cold War era handgun, out of the shed, shoots it twice into the air. The kids that are fleeing claim that they hear the bullets whizzing above their heads. Gerald then claims that he clears the gun by pressing the trigger some more into the air. And then he says he runs. His son says that he walks over to the driver's side of Bushy's car. Bushy's trying to get away. There's two girls in the car still. But there's a tire completely missing from Bushy's car, so he's not able to get away. Stanley walks up to the car. He claims that he is fearful of his walks or runs, fearful that his wife is under the tires. She'd be mowing the lawn. Stanley reaches in with his left hand in order to shut off the ignition, he claims. The gun is to Bushy's left ear behind it. Stanley claims, boom, the gun just went off. That's direct quote. Okay. He says that it was a hang fire, a very unlikely accident that most experts say occurs for only a fragment of a second every few hundred thousand shots, if at all. Mm-hmm. And the NRA claims it's a myth, hang fire. And the experts that test the gun claim that they've dropped it, they've tested it, they found no weird action, though they did find that one of the bullet casings was a bit expanded. So maybe the ammo had been stored unsafely. So is this a self-defense case? Well, Stanley's acquitted on the basis of his accident claim. He says it was an unlikely hang fire, this crazy freak accident. But that freak accident would have been a manslaughter conviction, hadn't it been for defense of property, which he claims explicitly. He says, I was allowed, Stanley, to shoot my gun into the air to scare off these kids off my property. Judge, defense, and Crown all concede this for some reason. Remember, there's been a smashing of the window and everything. So they're all, the car window. Nope, they're all agreeing. Then, remember, you're not allowed to kill somebody from your property. So he claims, Stanley, that he's worried about his wife being under the tires. So that gives him the right to kind of do something defensive to protect her, including causing death, if that's considered to be reasonable in the circumstances. The defense lawyer, though, for Stanley is worried that it's not going to be considered reasonable in the circumstances to kill an unarmed indigenous guy who's stuck in his car while everybody's fleeing in every which way possible. So he makes out the last element of self-defense, of defense of other, reasonable in the circumstances. Instead of proving that, he fills it in with the hang fire argument, the accident argument. Franken defense.
Okay. So, I was just about to say Frankenstein defense.
Yes. Why? Yeah. It's monster. Cobbled together from defense of property, defense of person, accident. Cormier is fading from defense of property to defense of person. Stanley, defense of property, person, accident. The defense is expanding like crazy. Very worrisome.
Mm-hmm. What did defense of person originally look like? There were some very specific criteria that had to be fulfilled originally before it was expanded.
Okay. So defensive person involved an unlawful assault against yourself. So that had to be shown, which was difficult to prove. Then the response had to be necessary and proportionate. And the attack itself had to be occurring or had to be imminent, like the attack was underway. This was the Wynot case that preceded the Lavallee case, where it said that you can't have a preemptive strike in self-defense. So what happened was that in 1990, the law made its first expansion when Lavallee, who was a horribly battered spouse, shot her abusive partner, Kevin Rust, in the back of the head as he was leaving the bedroom. He'd beaten her up, threatened to come back and kill her if she didn't kill him first. She'd been huddling in the closet. And then I think he handed her the gun even. And then the question was whether her actions were necessary and proportionate. Basically, whether they were reasonable in the circumstances. And the Supreme Court said, actually, in the past, it's not been considered reasonable. She could have called the police. But in the context of a battering relationship where the person is like a hostage, being held hostage, you can't expect the hostage to wait until the hostage taker is just about to kill them to try to escape. They have to be given the opportunity to escape at the first reasonable opportunity. And that's what Lavallee was doing. She's not a reasonable man in a bar fight where the bar fight opponent is walking away. She's a battered person, like the expert compared her to a concentration camp victim who's stuck in this relationship and doesn't see any way out reasonably. And so what she did was actually reasonable in the circumstances. We're not excusing her because she's a frail, battered woman, Justice Wilson said. We're saying that what she did was reasonable and justified. So that Lavallee case became the core of the self-defense law, the new Lucky Moose law. The reasonable in the circumstances was really inspired by Lavallee, and you can see this in the Justice Department's explanation. Mm-hmm. The problem arose with the Kill case. This is where my big worry came. I love Lavallee as a case. I think that it allowed for people who hadn't been able to use the defense, a variety of people who were attacked and marginalized and that were, it wasn't applicable to them, to suddenly be able to defend themselves. That's good. The problem is that it started to expand in very spooky ways in conjunction with the new self-defense law. So Peter Kill was a military reservist in Hamilton, Ontario, and he was asleep one night. He hears some shuffling in his driveway. He sneaks around with his shotgun. He sees John Stiers, who's an Indigenous guy, rifling through the glove box of his car, and he says, "Freeze." Stiers turns around towards him and Kill, K-H-I-L-L, shoots him with the shotgun and kills him. Kill claims that he was thought that maybe Stiers had a weapon. Stiers was unarmed except for a closed pocket knife in his pocket, small pocket knife that Kill didn't have any vision of, so it wasn't really a good explanation. Also, he was far away from Stiers. So, Kill claims self-defense under the new Lucky Moose law. This time he's not combining defensive property and defensive person in the same ways. What he's claiming is that as the reasonable military reservist, like the reasonable battered woman in Lavallee, he can't be expected to go inside the house and call the police. He's been trained to neutralize the threat. And Kill calls expert witnesses to say that a reasonable military reservist acts to neutralize the threat. They don't retreat. And the jury considers this to be sympathetic and reasonable, and they acquit Peter Kill of the killing on the basis of the new standard ground law and an expansion of Lavallee that I think is very spooky. The case is now on appeal. So we have yet to see whether the courts above are going to somehow limit the Lavallee defense so that it doesn't get changed into something that was meant for vulnerable people using self-defense in unusual ways to firearm carrying true men who are defending their property.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, reading Lavallee, I really like that case as well. I really like the reasoning of the judges, and it
I remember them talking about this kind of cycle of abuse and how battered women, because they've kind of been through this cycle with their abusive partners, they have a better understanding of when they will be abused next and perhaps the extent and nature of that abuse. They don't know when it might be set off, but they kind of have this heightened sense of, you know, this is happening now. And so I understood why in that sense they decided that, you know, she could have preemptively made the choice and used self-defense as opposed to when, you know, her husband had the gun to her head. In that decision, do you think they could have, instead of saying her actions were reasonable in the circumstances, said that to her there was imminent threat and still kind of kept it within the three specific criteria for self-defense?
Oh, that is interesting. In fact, that is what they did. Okay. So they, so good guess. Yeah. They interpreted imminence. The Supreme Court Justice Wilson wrote the judgment.
Yeah.
Interpreted imminence to, include, you know, a wider notion of imminence, that it wasn't just temporal, like the killing was about to occur, and that she understood what was imminent because of her pattern of abuse. The problem is this got extended in some other cases. Mm. So the McConnell case, I won't go through all the details, but this is a prison case where two guys in a prison gang were afraid of being attacked by another group, and they preemptively killed the person who they thought was going to attack them, and then they claimed self-defense, and it worked. So Lavallee has kind of expanded. This was a case even before the new standard, before the new Akimus law came into force. So Lavallee was already leading to peculiar expansions, preemption. Now, if you think about international law, you're like, okay, preemption was the explanation for the Americans to go into Iraq in 2003 in response to some terrorists that they couldn't identify launching an attack on the United States with weapons of mass destruction that hadn't been located. So some unknown attack, some unknown weapon, some unknown time in the future was used as a justification for self-defense. When you start looking at preemption as a possibility in Canadian law, it's no longer possible to measure proportionality any longer because the attack hasn't been launched yet. So you don't know it's a proportionate response. You don't know if it's necessary or not because the attack could be, could never come. So all of these different areas of kind of permission for do-it-yourself self-defense are being opened at once through the new Akimus law, 2012-2013.
I sort of see this as the latest chapter in kind of a long battle over that idea of, well, when is preemption okay? You know, we see that in 2003, but recently we've also seen it in down in the States and in Canada a bit too with cops. I feared for my life, and then they shoot an unarmed black man or George Zimmerman, right? And I think that's in the same pattern. We've sort of shifted from, well, in Lavallee, a very marginalized person can take advantage of this and say, yes, I did fear for my life. But now we're seeing people in positions of authority. I mean, the United States, 2003, the strongest nation in the world, is taking advantage of that sort of, we feared for our country, or cops, we feared for our lives.
So that's part of the story, Luke.
Yeah.
So this is part of the story about how these laws get enacted, is that the moral impetus for the creation of expanded self-defense laws has been, this is part of my paper, that vulnerable people need a different notion of imminence or of what's reasonable in the circumstances to be able to fairly use the defense, to justly use the defense. So, for example, the NRA in the US was saying that, well, at the same time as they were pushing for expansion of standard of self-defense laws, they're saying that we should be arming up women, and they had pictures of huddling white women in their nightgowns with handguns, and you imagine that it's going to be some African-American perpetrator. They're hinting at it in the pictures almost. So by expanding self-defense to them, then we're going to make the Florida a safer place. But it doesn't end up being these women that end up using the defense. It's not going to be David Chen's of the world, I think, that primarily are using Canada's expanded self-defense law. Who is it? It's the already aggressive guys that are ending up in these conflagrations and that are already armed. So these emboldened men then can take true men, I call it, because the original expansion of self-defense came from the Irwin versus Ohio case in the 1800s in the U.S., where the court said a true man who is without blame and not an Indian, even says in the case, doesn't have to retreat before using self-defense. Right. So it's these true men that I are going to be using the defense. That's my warning in my paper. I don't have empirical verification in Canada yet. There's not enough cases. But this is what's happened, the trend in the United States from Tampa Bay Times study, American Bar Association study showing disparate uses of these laws and application. I'm worried this could happen in Canada too.
Is there worry too just about who the victims of these crimes are going to be? Because I think we've seen already in the cases that you've mentioned that have come up in Canada that the victims of these self-defense laws are often minority or marginalized people, and they're the ones who seem to elicit the most violent responses from people who do feel threatened,
right?
You know, whether right or wrong.
Yeah. This is my worry. So if you look at the research in the US since 2005 about Stand Your Ground, yes, it's the people that kill a black person and then claim self-defense are more likely to be able to succeed with their defense than if they kill with the Stand Your Ground defense when they kill a white person. That's spooky. So is it going to happen with Indigenous people in Canada as well, with Muslim people? One of the parts of my theory is that in climates of fear, so places where there's intergroup conflict, communities start to arm up. So we're talking about rural Saskatchewan, Battleford, or New York City in the 70s and 80s, where it was rough and there was a lot of muggings going on. Or international hotspots like North Korea, the United States. When there's a climate of fear, then there's a temptation to arm up and start to prepare to preempt the other side's preemption. So it's the rush to strike first, because if you're struck already, then it's over already. So you prepare yourself, and this brings these communities closer and closer to a flashpoint. And it becomes harder and harder to tell who the aggressor is and who the defender is in these circumstances. I would like necessity and proportionality and imminence more clearly defined and retreat to be built back into the Canadian law through jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. That would be my hope.
Yeah. I was just going to say, through jurisprudence seems like the best way, because it, in my mind, it would be kind of a political hot potato to try and, you know, make a new law or go back to the old law through legislation. I don't know any party that would want to touch that. You seem to be reining that in, right?
Yeah, it's very, very tough to let it out once it's being done like this.
Right.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Professor Wiseboard, for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's great speaking with you guys. Really an honor to be invited to be on the show.
Oh, well, it's an honor to have you.
Yeah, thanks again. Thanks.
That's it for today's episode. Pro Bono Radio is brought to you by Queen's Faculty of Law, Pro Bono Students Canada, and with the generous support of CFRC, Queen's Campus Community Radio Station, broadcasting at 101.9 FM and online at cfrc.ca. The show was written and produced by the students of Queen's Law and is intended for entertainment purposes only. We are not lawyers. Nothing contained in the episode should be considered as legal advice. If you are in need of legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Pro Bono Radio is recorded at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory.